Well, I have 2 daughters.
Good evening. Good evening. May I have your attention? Yes. Thank you. Good evening. As always, we are really grateful for those of you who pitch in here and add your ideas.
Except you never use any of our ideas or really listen.
Jay, I don't think you can say that and be fair. Look, I am more than happy to look at your ideas.
Blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Chris is here to talk about some ways we are trying to include more physical activity in the curriculum to deal with this fatigue problem.
I'm sorry. What was that?
Sorry?
It's my first PTA meeting.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. I just was wondering, what is meant by the fatigue problem?
Yeah, I'm curious about that, too. It's also my first PTA meeting. I work. Hi.
The fatigue problem is what was identified in the first quarter of the school year as being a marked decline in the spirit and interest and energy of the kids here. Usually around noon or right after lunch.
It's because of the lunch. They aren't given enough time to eat.
No, it's not that. They're being demoralized. You fill them with academics. You don't tell them who they are.
For now, we are focusing on the lack of physical activity. Now, we still don't have a gym because of last year's diarrhea flood.
Excuse me.
Yes.
My name is Nancy Cartesian. My son is never Cartesian.
Oh, Jesus.
He has definitely suffered from the fatigue syndrome. In my opinion, it's because of the competitive nature of the school, of the children.
I've been reading about this Reggio teaching method from Italy. It's like Montessori, only it's a little bit more creative.
When are they supposed to dance?
It's the academics. This place is still stuck in the 70s. Who still teaches math anymore?
We've been talking about introducing some competitive sports.
I think our kids just need to be allowed to play more creatively.
You are all way off. This problem
is... Isn't it just... It's school, right? So, I mean, school sucks, right? I mean, you do what you can to improve it, but it's not, it's, in the end, there's a limit. Because it's school. And school sucks. Remember?
Hey, can I get one of those?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think your school sucks initiative is gonna get much support.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
When I was a baby, I had to care in the world. But now I'm a man with trouble.
There is perhaps nothing more important to know about children than that they need to make sense out of their experience. In effect, they need to know that the universe is rational. They need to know that human existence is knowable, predictable, and stable. On that foundation, they can build a sense of efficacy. Without it, the task is worse than difficult. Sanity in family life is one of a child's most urgent needs. If healthy development is to be possible. What does sanity mean in this context? It means adults who, for the most part, say what they mean and mean what they say. It means rules that are understandable, consistent, and fair. It means not being punished today for behavior that was ignored or even rewarded yesterday. It means a home in which reality is appropriately acknowledged. It means parents who practice what they preach. Who are willing to admit when they make mistakes and apologize when they know they have been unfair or unreasonable. It means parents who reward and reinforce consciousness in a child rather than discourage and penalize it. If, instead of obedience, we want cooperation from our children, if, instead of conformity, we want self-responsibility, we can achieve it in a home environment that supports the child's mind. We cannot achieve it in an environment intrinsically hostile to the exercise of mind. We want to teach our children healthy ideas and values. Ideas and values are most powerfully communicated when they are embedded into family life, rooted into the being of the parents. Regardless of what we think we're teaching, we teach what we are.
Moving into the second part of the book and the next section, nurturing a child's self-esteem. There's a lot for us, like you said, to still talk about, but this was certainly a very impactful chapter that we decided we should really devote a whole show to, because not only does it help to make concrete some of the things that we've covered in the six pillars so far, but it also relates to what we've been talking on the show about for years here.
Yeah. This is the bedrock, isn't it, for a society where individuals are respected, you know, and I can't think of anything more important than the nature of child rearing to ensure a society that's respectful of people's freedoms and, you know, their abilities, their creativity, and their own sovereignty. Like, you know, he starts out by saying that we want to have children mature and become independent beings, become autonomous. Yeah. And we all know about the autonomy wars that happen between parents and children. It's almost nonstop in our culture, you know.
Yeah. And one of the criticisms that I've drawn over and over again when I'm being critical of the government school system is, you know, people urging me to accept that young people need to be prepared for the real world, for the, you know, the harsh realities of the real world. And you know, when I usually tell them first, and if they're still interested, I can tell them more, the real world is the thing that we're very much trying to change.
Yeah. Yeah. The real world sounds like settling for the status quo to me, you know?
Yeah. You know, so we're not trying to feed it with education.
Yeah. But you can kind of get the inclination why people would advocate that. It's not really challenging. It's not disturbing their systems that they're in. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just taking things as the given, keeping their head down, not getting out of line, and everything's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in that context where we're submitting rather than asserting our autonomy, living with the practice of self-assertiveness and all the other practices, that is the what's going to foster our self-esteem. But when we're submitting, we can't really do that. So our self-esteem gets injured in this process of conforming to systems. And the main one is, of course, the family system, preceding the school system. If the family system is dysfunctional and not nurturing of a child's self-esteem, invariably they're going to send that child to a school where that system will, you know, impose similar punishments, rewards, strictures, all kinds of things on the child, and debilitate their self-esteem even more.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, as much as I have criticized school and institutionalized adolescence in the form of, like, the boarding school that I used to work at, for a lot of the kids I interacted with in my career, this was kind of a respite from family life. It's hard to believe, because I saw some pretty demented environments school-wise. But, you know, the people who were working in those school environments often saw themselves as, you know, the saviors for a lot of these kids. And sometimes, you know, even though those environments weren't free of their own unique problems, that was actually in many ways true. It's a hard thing to acknowledge, but it was definitely for many of these kids a respite.
Yeah. Yeah. He notes a couple of interesting things here. A child can experience the appropriate balance of protection and freedom, or one, the overprotectiveness that infantilizes, or two, the underprotectiveness that demands of the child resources that may not yet exist. So the feeling of being overwhelmed by all kinds of duties and obligations and responsibilities, you know? So both of those things don't necessarily nurture a child's sense of individuation and autonomy and, you know, provide a safe, secure place, a launching pad, if you will, place to come back to. You know, it gets back into the attachment theory by Bowlby and so forth. We want secure attachment, not ambivalent attachment or insecure attachment. We want secure attachment so that the child knows that they're in a safe place, in a secure place, and they're trusted and they're loved, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the best way to say it would be, I just remember so much of what was going on inside me feeling weird and alien to the rest of the world, despite my parents, dare I say, doing maybe the best they knew how to communicate.
And where do you suppose they learned that, right?
Oh, my
God. In their upbringings, right?
Yeah. And for that, I mean, I'll take letters about this if people have objections, but they did much better than what was done to them, you know? And I see my brothers doing better than my parents did today. So that's encouraging, at least in my family. Now, obviously, there are more severe examples of abuse and disconnection and disowning disrespect, where that just is kind of perpetuated generation after generation. But
yeah,
you know, I remember, and I realized this in retrospect, you know, that whole what's wrong with me? What's wrong with my mind? And just not really having a vocabulary to communicate that, you know, but we all have this natural desire to be seen, to be heard, to be understood, to participate in the world around us, you know, and I guess maybe this has a little bit to do with some of our training, you know, in family and in school to belong to it. So yeah. I remember just feeling like very much a weirdo. And that was the first thought that occurred to me when I started reading through this chapter, Nurturing a Child's Self-Esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And was really searching for personal experience. Like, how does this relate to my experience? I was really also moved by a question that he asks, what would happen if we extended the courtesy we have for, you know, adults, like strange visitors to our home, to our own children? If we extended that courtesy to our own children. And, you know, I started to think, like, there were real examples of this, you know, in my childhood. Like, when I would observe my parents, mostly my mother's behavior, and I would say, why are her tones different with me and Adam, you know, my younger brother? It was my only other brother at the time. And maybe
as if there were favoritism of some sort.
Not like a difference.
Double standards.
Not even like a difference between the way she talked to me and Adam, but the way she talked to me and other adults.
Oh, okay.
You know? And I was like, wow, these people must be just super important or special. And, you know, to her credit, she changed a lot, especially during my adult life, and was kind of and I've talked about this on the show before, she was kind of a wreck, you know, when I was little, and very reactive and would raise her voice a lot. But definitely, I don't remember courtesy being extended to me or my brother. And I guess I started to ask the question, there's probably some value in trying to understand the need or the fear behind the scolding of children like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I have some experience with it as a teacher, but I think it was always just this fear of not being able to maintain control. You know, that was the most direct translation. And there's probably obviously a deeper need attached to that. But that, especially when I was a young teacher, that was my big concern. If I lose control, it's over. You know, I'm fired. So I...
Yeah, which speaks to efficacy. You know, if I'm out of control, then I'm not efficacious. I'm not doing the job that's outlined for me. You know, I'm not a good teacher or a good parent. And I remember Marshall Rosenberg saying that, you know, if you want to live a miserable life, just try to become a good parent. Try to be a good parent as opposed to a bad parent. Because when we're in that role of good or bad, we're not seeing each other as humans. We're just seeing each other as roles. I'm the parent, you're the child. Like, how many times do we see that where, you know, because I said so is used, or because I'm your mother, because I'm your father. So by definition, because of this role, you need to obey. You need to conform. You need to comply. You need to do what I think is best for you.
Well, yeah. And we can kind of walk that through right into adulthood when people have parents who cannot acknowledge that they make mistakes and they're putting on this facade of being perfect. And they're also presented and eventually understood as the protectors and the legitimate authorities Couple that with infallibility, it's dangerous.
It's a potent mix, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessitate tyranny, but it can definitely sow the seeds. And, you know, the relationship between state and citizen is oftentimes related to the relationship of parent and child. It's a bit different with statism because you're dealing with strangers typically. A cop pulls you over, you don't really know them by their first name, and they are authorized to kill you if you disobey in some way that they don't like, you know?
Right.
So there's complete conformity that's required there. Otherwise, you're going to be tased, pepper sprayed, or even killed. Whereas with a child who's disobedient with parents, you know, there's punishment. You know, Brandon has vignettes in here talking about, you know, a client who was beat mercilessly with a belt by his father at such an early age that he felt completely helpless. And to this day, at age 34, has anxiety. Like, he has no control and efficacy, cannot affect change in his world in the way that he wants because of that, you know, stripping him of his own autonomy and his own choice from such an early age and violating boundaries, not respecting the needs of children, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that that need for respect is such a critical one in early life. And unfortunately, the system of parenting that exists presently is quite conditional. You know, I did a series talking about Alfie Kohn's book, Unconditional Parenting, you know, moving from rewards and punishment to love and reason.
Yeah.
And Alfie's just pointing out all the ways that present systems in families lead to basically sacrifice of children's needs rather than love and reason, respect and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was speaking before about some of my experience as a young boy, I can remember, and it's always like I say I can remember, but these are kind of things that were labeled in retrospect, but a need for visibility. And it didn't seem...
It's a huge one.
Yeah, it didn't seem like there was, except for certain times, like it was certainly up to my parents when I was visible, you know, because my dad was a very busy man. He traveled all the time. My mom was a pretty stressed out young mother of eventually three boys, of whom I was the oldest. And I figured out a way to a little trick, a little cheat to get visible. And it was to do something wrong. And it's funny how many times I watched that replicated throughout my career over and over and over and over again. And like right up, like for the first 8 years, was personally offended by it every time. Could not see that it was exactly, you know, the routine that I had used. You know,
the expression of that trauma, you know, trying to get your needs for acknowledgement, consideration, understanding, that visibility. You know, he has sections in here talking about nurturing through touch and love and acceptance and respect, and visibility is his last one he covers. And there's a stem he uses. If I had felt visible to my parents, and he gives endings by clients, I wouldn't feel so alienated from people today. I would have felt like a member of the human race. I would have felt safe. I would have felt visible to myself. I would have felt loved. I would have felt there was hope. I would have felt like one of the family. I would have felt connected. I would be sane. I would have been helped to understand myself. I would have felt I had a home. I would have felt I belonged.
Yeah.
There's that belonging need once again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to recap on the visibility thing, he writes, if I say or do something and you respond in a way that I perceive as congruent in terms of my own behavior, if I become playful and you become playful in turn, or if I express joy and you show understanding of my state, or if I express sadness and you convey empathy, or if I do something I am proud of and you smile in admiration, I feel seen and understood by you. I feel visible. In contrast, if I say or do something and you respond in a way that makes no sense to me in terms of my own behavior, if I become playful and you react as if I were being hostile, or if I express joy and you display impatience and tell me not to be silly, or if I express sadness and you accuse me of pretending, or if I do something I am proud of and you react with condemnation, I do not feel seen and understood. I feel invisible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So these messages can be subtle and not so subtle in the parenting paradigm. And, you know, in this role of being a good parent, when the parent sees the child, quote, misbehaving, that is an indication that they're not being a good parent, because good parents have obedient children, do they not?
Well, that's, I think that's what it is. And that relates to what my fear was, you know, as a teacher, you know, that what other people are going to see when so many people just live completely blindingly accepting what good parenting is. It's like, you know, being a good farmer almost, like all the animals. No, there's animals aren't running wild and, you know, galloping all over the place and trampling things. They're under control. They're well behaved. They're not bothering the adults.
Yeah.
You know, basically, they're not being children at all. But yeah, that feeling of thinking you're going to get one reaction and getting the opposite, you know, thinking like, oh, look what I'm doing. I'm pretty good, you know, and getting this totally negative reaction, you know, when you're just trying to have fun. Yeah, that's really harsh and memorable, you know. And it doesn't take too many of those experiences to leave a really negative imprint, you know, that leads to people walking on eggshells. Well into adulthood, I think.
Yeah, and have feelings that are relatively inexplicable from the standpoint of adulthood. You know, a lot of people carry this stuff with them, this unacknowledged, unprocessed trauma. And, you know, it manifests as adults, and we have a hard time relating it to what exactly happened in childhood, you know. This section under Nurturing Through Touch, he wrote, children who grow up with little experience of being touched often carry an ache deep within them that never entirely vanishes. There is a hole in this in their self-regard. Why could I never sit on my father's knee? Clients will say. Why did mother convey such reticence, even disgust about physical touch? The unspoken sentence is, why did they not love me enough to want to hold me? And sometimes, if my own parents didn't want to touch me, how can I expect anyone else to want to?
Mm-hmm.
The pain of this childhood deprivation is difficult to bear. Usually it is repressed. Consciousness contracts and psychic numbing is evoked as a survival strategy to make existence tolerable.
Yeah.
These coping mechanisms that we form, you know, self-awareness is avoided. This is often the start of a pattern that lasts a lifetime. Depending on other psychological factors, we can see two different responses to touch deprivation later in life. On one level, they appear opposite, yet both express alienation and both are harmful to self-esteem. On the one hand, we may see in an adult an avoidance of intimate contact with other human beings, a withdrawal from human encounters, expressing feelings of fear and unworthiness, a failure of self-assertiveness, among other things. Or we may see compulsive sexual promiscuity, an unconscious effort to heal the wound of touch starvation, but in a way that humiliates without resolving. And personal integrity and self-respect are two of the casualties. Both responses leave the individual isolated from authentic human contact.
Yeah.
And I guess the human contact with oneself, too. Like Brandon says, we are lonely for ourselves. Because when we grew up in a context in which we didn't get that visibility of who ourself was and what we are in terms of our capacities and our worthiness for happiness, then we can draw these conclusions. You know, the beliefs about ourselves, reality, and so forth. Brandon has another chapter dealing with a philosophy of self-esteem that I think we'll probably wrap up with.
Yeah.
But they're very prevalent, the beliefs that we take away from these early experiences.
So if you think it's okay to transition, there's kind of a flip side to what we've been discussing here. He labels it inappropriate praise, you know, because I'm thinking about what most of these people's experiences have been. And I say to myself, well, you know, I'm kind of lucky that never dealt with that, had the same experience when I was reading the book. But I think one of the things anyway that wound up being so troublesome was inconsistency. You know, I remember one of my first memories was like, I didn't think there could be a better day. I was like maybe five, and I was a late reader, and I was in kindergarten. And, you know, I was sitting in the family room with my mother, and we were going through some book. And she had been a teacher, so she was teaching me to read, and I was doing well, and it was just praise, 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 praise. Then, Wes, you would not believe what happened. My first tooth falls out.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she was going to pass out. I thought she was like so excited. I had never seen my mother so proud in my entire adolescence on until I was an adult.
It was ecstasy unrestrained, joyous rapture.
Yeah, it wasn't until I was an adult that I saw her express that kind of pride in me again. But, you know, it was like labels. And they didn't only come from parents, you know? It was like, you're a good boy. You're a very good boy. Mm-hmm. You're very well behaved. You please me, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, he talks about this inappropriate praise. And he also makes this distinction between evaluative and appreciative praise. And I think this is so important. We're encouraging, as adults or parents or teachers, young people to ask the question, what is? What exists? You know, and to live kind of in harmony with what is, with what exists. So don't say, you're a good boy. I've labeled you good. Oh, I have a sticker, you know, has stars on it. It says, great job, with an exclamation point. There you go. Now it's a badge you wear.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how these carrots still affect me as an adult recently, like in recent weeks. You know, so that's evaluative praise. You know, you're making a judgment versus appreciative praise, where you're actually showing a young person that you, well, appreciate what they've done or who they are or how they contribute to your world. You know, you state the facts and then you give a young person an opportunity to do an evaluation. Don't do it for them. You rob them of that opportunity to take the facts of reality and make a conclusion.
Yeah. What we don't want to do, let me phrase that in the positive, what we want to do is rely on our own judgment and self-appraisal for our self-esteem rather than the judgment of others. Because when we defer in that way, then we're at a loss about a secure, stable base for ourselves because we can always be at the mercy of someone else's judgment. You know, and this type, different types of praise is mentioned by a friend of Brandon's, a psychotherapist named Haim Ganat.
Yeah.
And he's no longer alive, but he wrote a couple books. One is Teacher and Child. And in that book, he wrote, in psychotherapy, a child is never told, you are a good little boy. You are doing great. Carry on your good work. Judgmental praise is avoided. Why? Because it is not helpful. It creates anxiety, invites dependency, and evokes defensiveness. It is not conducive to self-reliance, self-direction, and self-control. These qualities demand freedom from outside judgment. They require reliance on inner motivation and evaluation. To be himself, one needs to be free from the pressure of evaluative praise. You know, praise in general is difficult because we are tending to stand and judge of something. And I really like Marshall Rosenberg's perspective in nonviolent communication about how you translate this into the language of giraffe when you speak in terms of feelings and needs, something that's really helpful. And, you know, in his videos, like that 3-hour workshop, I think it is, on YouTube, he talks about how people, say a person comes up to him and says, Marshall, you're brilliant, you know? And he says, well, I've been told a lot of things and I'm a lot of things. And that's really not as helpful as if you were to tell me what really inspired you. Like, so I feel really excited to talk with you because when I listened to you speak, it really met my need for understanding about this trouble I was having with my son or something like this.
Yeah.
You know, this is a much more detailed informational process than just simple praise where we stand in judgment. I know it's easy. It's shorthand. Good work. Good job. You know, that kind of thing that, you know, shows appreciation sometimes too. But it's important to really grok it, to get inside and find out, okay, so what's live in us that's contributing to our own well-being and sense of enrichment by looking at the other person. So in that respect, we become an equal. We remain an equal with the other. We don't stand in judgment so that we don't foster the approval addiction that Brandon mentions in here too.
We don't grow up into a world of likes and shares.
Exactly. You hear that, Mr. Zuckerberg?
No, sorry.
So yeah, some parents are intent on helping their children's self-esteem, but they praise globally, indiscriminately, and extravagantly. At best, this does not work. At worst, it backfires. The child feels invisible and anxious. In addition, this policy tends to produce approval addicts, children who cannot take a step without looking for praise and who feel disvalued if it is not forthcoming. Many devoted parents with the best intentions in the world, but without the appropriate skills, have turned their children into such approval addicts by saturating the home environment with their, quote, loving evaluations. Yeah, so if we're nurturing autonomy, he wrote, always leave space for the child to make his or her own evaluations. So that's really key. And I think we'll get into more of that when we talk about self-esteem in schools, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like the term that he uses, approval addicts. It's very, you know, simple, but Very true. And I think I've been one, and I think I've seen a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's also the criticism aspect. In addition to praise, we can punish with criticism, labels, you know?
Yeah.
Like Curie says, many an adult in psychotherapy complains of still hearing the internalized voices of mother or father telling them that they are, quote, bad or, quote, rotten or, quote, stupid,
yeah,
or, quote, worthless. Often they struggle toward a better life against the gravitational pull of those abusive terms, fighting not to succumb to their parents' dark view of them. They do not always succeed, since self-concept tends to turn into destiny through the principle of self-fulfilling prophecies. We need to consider what self-concept we wish to promote. If we can rebuke without violating or demeaning a child's dignity, if we can respect a child's self-esteem even when we are angry, we have mastered one of the most challenging and important aspects of competent parenting.
Yeah.
So
this extends beyond the family as well, because I remember watching for a long time, a lot of young people live into their labels, right?
Mm-hmm.
And labels were excuses. And sometimes it was just some diagnosis that had been given to them, you know, by school psychologists. I have ADHD, that kind of thing. But what seemed to be much more common, even when there was no specific DSM-4 label to slap on a person, I've always been treated like I'm bad. So I behave badly. That was very, very common. And he says in the book, we do not inspire better behavior by impugning a child's worth or intelligence or morality or character or intentions. Nobody ever becomes good. I'm paraphrasing, but nobody ever becomes good because you tell them that they're bad. It took a long time for me to learn this, right? When I used to tell people that they were immoral.
The moralistic judgment to tell people that their behavior is rotten, for instance, any kind of criticism. And it's easy to relive this trauma as an adult when we haven't fully processed it. And I think it's really important to develop relationships with friends and loved ones and lovers, romantic partners, to create a safe space so we can heal these psychic wounds, essentially, that were inflicted early on, these ideas, these beliefs, these statements, these words live in our heads sometimes, and they come out when we're feeling triggered, when we're not feeling resourceful, and when we're, you know, fearful about something or distrustful, you know, and if anyone can be masters at pushing buttons, it's children with parents, right?
Yeah.
Like, they know exactly the ones to push, it seems. The parent is kind of flabbergasted at how well the child pushes their buttons, right?
Yeah.
But what's really being pushed is the same experiences that that parent had when they were a child, trying to assert their need for autonomy or choice or respect or get attention, get acknowledgement through these real tragic ways sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I like what he wrote about love, you know? A child who is treated with love tends to internalize the feeling and to experience him or herself as lovable. Love is conveyed by verbal expression, nurturing actions, and the joy and pleasure we show in the sheer fact of the child's being. And he says, unfortunately, many of us received messages like we're not enough. You may have potential, but you are unacceptable as you are. You need to be fixed. One day you may be enough, but not now. You will be enough only if you fulfill our expectations. Quote, I am enough does not mean, quote, I have nothing to learn and nowhere to grow to. It means I accept myself as a value as I am, you know, down to that deepest core of self, right?
Yeah.
We cannot build self-esteem on a foundation of I am not enough. To convey to a child you are not enough is to subvert self-esteem at the core. No child feels loved who receives such messages. And yet such messages are sent implicitly and explicitly all the time. And that's why we live in the effed up culture that we do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was followed by acceptance. A child whose thoughts and feelings are treated with acceptance tends to internalize the response and to learn self-acceptance. Acceptance is conveyed not by agreement, which is not always possible, but by listening to and acknowledging the child's thoughts and feelings, and by not chastising, arguing, lecturing, psychologizing, or insulting. Yeah. If a child is repeatedly told that he or she must not feel this, must not feel that, the child is encouraged to deny and disown feelings and emotions in order to please or placate parents. If normal expressions of excitement, anger, happiness, sexuality, longing, and fear are treated as unacceptable or wrong or sinful or otherwise distasteful to parents, the child may disown and reject more and more of the self to belong, to be loved, to avoid the terror of abandonment. Yeah, the terror of abandonment. Yeah. We do not serve a child's development by making self-repudiation the price of our love.
He has a section, too, where he uses the word sanity, right?
Yeah.
And that's what, as you read, that's what I'm being reminded of. Sanity for healthy development. Child definitely has an urgent need for that throughout most of his or her young life. And he defines this sanity as adults who say what they mean and mean what they say, adults who are consistent. And sanity creates an environment where reality, like I said before, is appropriately acknowledged. So you think about consistent in the appropriate acknowledgement of reality. And we've addressed, you know, the parents who can't admit that they make mistakes because I said so, how common that is. And also the request or the demand, I guess, to deny what a young person might be experiencing. That's inconvenient for me.
Yeah.
Right. So that reality is not appropriately acknowledged.
Yeah. So it reminds me of a talk I heard with some NVC trainers. I think it was just a dialogue or an interview. And they said, you know, ideally what we want is for parents to do 1 hour of parenting and then 2 hours of getting empathy in our culture that exists today, because the empathy tank for parents is quite empty a lot of the time.
Oh, sure.
So to have them get empathy, to get a sense of resourcefulness, to be able to deal with the challenging aspects of parenting, because they are challenging. Absolutely. Nothing to deny there.
Yeah.
But it's important to find ways that are win-win to deal with children that are respectful. And I really loved his statements about respect. You know, a child who receives respect from adults tends to learn self-respect. Respect is conveyed by addressing a child with the courtesy one normally extends to adults. Right?
Mm-hmm.
As child psychologist Chaim Gnat used to say or observe, if a visiting guest accidentally spills a drink, we do not say, "Oh, you're so sloppy. What's the matter with you?" You know, we don't tell this to guests.
Right.
But then why do we think such statements are appropriate for our children?
Right.
Especially ones that are learning to master space, learning dexterity, and all these things that are important, who are much more important to us than the visitor. Surely it would be more appropriate to say to the child something like, "You've spilled your drink. Will you get some paper towels from the kitchen? You know, I'll help you clean it up."
Yeah.
I recall a client once saying to me, "My father talks to any busboy with more courtesy than he's ever extended to me."
Exactly.
"Please and thank you are words that acknowledge dignity, that of the speaker as well as the listener."
Yeah.
And so it reminds me of Rosenberg saying that all we're doing is saying please and thank you, however tragically, you know?
And it's a bummer, too. When you have a parent or an authority figure and you observe them do this with the busboy or the mailman or the neighbor, and you say, "Oh, shit, looks like that person is capable of, like, treating other people with dignity."
Yes.
I'd like some of that.
So why the double standard, right?
Yeah. And like I said, I'll stress what I said before. It just wasn't delivered consistently. You know? Mm-hmm.
And the unpredictability of what you're going to get in terms of visibility can be really disorienting as a child, for a child.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from my experience, I withdrew. I became really shy, introverted. And there's a quote at the back of this chapter that I'd like to mention because it really reflected kind of that psychological milieu that I was in at the time. And it took a lot to climb out of that internalized sort of blame, I guess, and disorientation, you know. But here it says, "Parents need to be informed. Be careful what you say to your children. They may agree with you. Before calling a child, quote, stupid or clumsy or bad or a disappointment, consider the question, is this how I want my child to experience him or herself?"
Yeah.
And this speaks to the relationships that child is going to have as an adult, friendships and romantic partners, you know. How are they going to view themselves? Are they going to see themselves as lovable, worthy of respect and giving respect, right?
Yeah.
If a child grows up in a home where everyone deals with everyone else with natural, good-natured courtesy, he or she learns principles that apply both to self and to others. Respect of self and others feels like the normal order of things, which properly it is. The fact that we love a child does not guarantee that respect will be automatic. Lapses of consciousness are always possible, no matter how loving our feelings. Once, when my granddaughter Ashley was 5, I was whirling her around, laughing with her, and enjoying myself so much that I didn't stop when she said, "I want to be put down now, Grandpa." But I caught myself an instant later when she said solemnly, "Grandpa, you're not listening to me." And then I said, "Sorry, sweetheart," and obeyed.
Yeah.
So waking up to the needs of children, that's kind of the gist of that. Hold children's needs with equal care as our needs as adults, and to find win-win strategies. I mean, that's kind of the essence of the unconditional parenting, or the nonviolent communication model of parenting, compassionate communication.
Yeah, and the it's so important, I think, for the parents and the adults who are observing these children or interacting with these children to remember the sort of missing context of that adult life. Like, I see the young children in my family really not aware of like adult lack of energy or adult busy schedule. Because if they're like 5, how the hell would they possibly be like, "Oh, yes, I see that you're really worn down. Tough day at the office and the commute. Oh, you know, that's not part of their thought process." I would say that extends to kids who are much older, you know. And school might even, in a lot of ways, create more of a vacuum, right? When kids get to be 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, they're maybe pressing on their parents a little bit more for that love and acceptance, because school is not a place, you know, where there's any kind of genuine appreciation or constructive criticism. It's all very formulaic, and you're kind of lost in a sea of other kids who are trying to be controlled. So
yeah.
When you mentioned that story and you said, "Grandpa, you're not listening to me," what a wonderful thing for a young person to say.
Isn't it?
At the very least, it can, like, there is such a thing as can't drop everything every time you ask. That's a problem too. That's not, and you don't have to say that. You don't have to, you know, ignore. I mean, I've seen children be ignored. "Hey, hey, hey, listen. I can't drop everything every time you," then it just,
"I'm on the phone. Can you see?"
Yeah, exactly. But somebody who just, you know, like throws the phone over their shoulder and immediately kneels down, that's not really teaching a respect for reality either.
Yeah.
It's so easy for me to have really wonderful suggestions for parents, not being one myself. It's super easy.
Indeed. Yes. That's a common criticism and complaint, I guess, you know, is that how can these people, adults who don't have children, talk about parenting, talk about nurturing a child's self-esteem? Well, the great thing was we were all children once. We all have that experience. Every parent was a child once. So that's the common denominator. And I think just paying attention to those needs within us as we were children is really important. And that can lead to a whole host of insights and changes in our own behavior, whether or not we're a parent, you know, because we all interface with children at one time or another. And we have a chance to catch the gleam in their eye walking by them in the supermarket and show them that respect or joy or, you know, those things that really mean a lot visibility wise.
Yeah.
And Brandon actually has the 24 questions in here that he put in Breaking Free and Honoring the Self. And I like that he's put a question at the end of each one, kind of a summation question. It's kind of a child's wish list about how you were treated or how you experienced yourself as a child in the family system. And I think it's really helpful to go through those questions and to process that trauma, process those experiences in a new way as an adult, so that we don't end up reliving it constantly in our lives, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That we can make new decisions and change our strategies to ones that fulfill our lives, to enrich our lives, rather than to, you know, pursue strategies that come at cost, that sacrifice various needs for the sake of other needs, you know?
Yeah. And not to relive those traumas as parents, you know? Now, obviously,
absolutely,
we can't do it perfectly. It's an ongoing process, lifelong process. I really believe that. But as far as, like, you know, minimizing the traumas we relive as parents, it's really important. And right at the end of the chapter, he has this great line where he says, "Regardless of what we think we are teaching, we teach what we are."
Yeah, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? And, you know, the section he has on dealing with mistakes, I think this is one of the biggest ones we've talked about: fallibility, the nature of making mistakes, you know, and taking responsibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Living purposefully, practice of self-acceptance, asserting ourselves, living with integrity, all these involve our fallibility, don't they?
Yes.
I mean, he says a child learns to walk through a series of false moves. Gradually, he or she eliminates the moves that don't work and keeps the moves that do. Making mistakes is integral to the process of learning to walk. Making mistakes is integral to a great deal of learning. If a child is chastised for making a mistake, or ridiculed, humiliated, or punished, or if the parent steps in impatiently and says, "Here, let me do it," and that's a common thing, he or she cannot feel free to struggle and learn. A natural process of growth is sabotaged. To avoid mistakes becomes a higher priority than to master new challenges. A child who does not feel accepted by parents if he or she makes a mistake may learn to practice self-rejection in response to mistakes. Consciousness is muted. Self-acceptance is undermined. Self-responsibility and self-assertiveness are suppressed. Given the chance, children will usually learn from their mistakes naturally and spontaneously. Sometimes it can be useful to ask, non-critically and non-pedantically, "What did you learn? What might you do differently next time?" It reminds me, when he talks about children naturally learning, you know, and spontaneously learning, The Secret of Childhood is one of my favorite books on child psychology by Maria Montessori.
Yeah.
And she really explains the psychology of children mastering their space, becoming more adept at doing things, and feeling joyful in the process.
Yeah. I really encourage people, I mean, to catch themselves too, as parents and adults or teachers, whether they're listening to the show and they know they struggle with this, or I've certainly, you know, given this advice. It's not always like, "Oh, hi, here I am with no kids for more advice." But, you know, I usually do preface my advice with the fact that, you know, I dealt with a lot of kids who were not mine and didn't care about me and could have just gotten together and decided to murder me one day if they wanted to, and did a lot of things wrong for sure, but learned some valuable lessons, and asked that question that was always so discouraged when we were young. Why? Blank. You know, parents don't ask it. So here's an example. I caught myself, like, I was home maybe a month ago. I have a niece, and she's like 8. And she started to struggle with her weight a little bit. She seems like she's becoming very dependent on food. And I, you know, watch her kind of barrel into my mom's house and go right to the food and, like, just start touching things that she's not going to eat, like moving things around with her hands. And, you know, you're talking about this spatial awareness, or this awareness of needs that other people have. I felt myself be like, you know, "What the fuck? You know, what are you doing?" Not, you know, just a thought that crossed my mind. Like, what are you doing? You know, she's 8. And then asking why, and realizing that she lives in, unfortunately, a fair amount of chaos, you know, separated parents, maybe emotionally unstable mom, third grade.
Not much security and stability there, right?
Not much security there. Her father and her mother kind of going back and forth. We're getting back together. We're not getting back together. Mom is with a new guy. Mom is breaking up with the guy. Look, mom is interested in dad again. You know, that kind of inconsistency that, yeah, when you're 8, you can't just go to the liquor cabinet. But that's probably how you feel, you know, when you have to live in that kind of instability.
Yeah.
So I encourage people to just hold the lip, especially teachers, because I was not good at that when I was a teacher. I was immediately critical, you know, scornful, judgmental, and didn't understand that sometimes even if you mean ridicule as a joke, it's not always integrated that way.
And it's also important to really identify the feelings of pain and confusion, frustration, upset in the child as they're dealing with a rather unpredictable, chaotic environment, an insecure one, you know? Mm-hmm. So dealing with feelings of insecurity in a constructive way, nurturing that for children. You know, he has some stems here in terms of making mistakes that are pretty poignant. So when I catch myself making a mistake, I tell myself I'm stupid. I call myself a klutz. I feel like a loser. I feel frightened. I wonder what will happen when I'm found out. I tell myself it's pointless to try. I tell myself it's unforgivable. I feel self-contempt. If someone had told me it's all right to make mistakes, I'd be a different person. I wouldn't make so many mistakes. I wouldn't be so afraid to try anything. I wouldn't be so self-critical. I'd be more open. I'd be more adventuresome. I'd accomplish more. Yeah. If I had the courage to allow myself mistakes, I would not make as many mistakes. I'd be careful but more relaxed. I could enjoy my work. I would take more chances with new ideas. I'd have more ideas. I could be more creative. I'd be happier. I would not be irresponsible. Yeah, and here's an important one. If I were more compassionate about my mistakes, I wouldn't feel doomed, and I would try harder. I would give more. I'd like myself more. I wouldn't be depressed. I would be more conscious. I wouldn't struggle with all this fear. I'd be my own man and not my parents' little boy. Common themes. These things are given by clients in therapy settings, but we all can relate to these things, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And he has a recommendation here for parents having a family dinner in which he asks parents to commit to have at least one major family dinner a week at which all members are present. I ask the dinner be slow and leisurely and that everyone be invited to talk about his or her activities and concerns. No lectures, no sermons, no patronizing, just sharing of experiences. Everyone treated with love and respect. The theme is self-expression and self-disclosure and the sustaining of connections. Many parents who agree with the project in principle find they need considerable discipline in its execution.
Right.
The urge to condescend, to patronize, pontificate, and can be powerful. They can stifle self-expression even while demanding it. If, however, they can overcome the impulse to be, quote, authorities, if they can express thoughts and feelings simply and naturally with their children and invite the same self-expression in return, they offer a profound psychological gift to their children and to themselves. They help create a sense of, quote, belonging in the best sense of that word. That is, they create a sense of family. They create an environment in which self-esteem can grow.
Absolutely.
Shall we wrap up with this last section, strategic detachment?
Sure.
Because he's kind of speaking to this possibility as a child, what children do, you know, we pursue all these different strategies in order to get some needs met for love and belonging and acceptance.
Absolutely.
And it can come at costs of other needs. And we learn that those needs maybe aren't as important as other ones in life. And maybe we don't even identify the needs that we're trying to get met, you know?
I would say that's not to generalize, but the last one seems very common. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's difficult amidst all the confusion to sort through it all. And obviously the passage of time tends to heal some things, but those wounds are deep within. And if they're not explored and reprocessed in a mature, helpful way, then we can end up going off the rails at various times in life and not having as enriching a life and wonderful a life as everyone's birthright is, you know? We have this birthright of happiness, just to be present in our experience and be happy with just the nature of things as we experience them. I think that sort of mindfulness is an important component of happiness. And I was in an NBC teleconference the other day with Jim and Jory Mansky from Hawaii. And Jim was leading a session talking about just being mindful, just taking in the present moment and experiencing it and realizing that that is the nature of happiness. It's not some place in the future to achieve something, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, living up to some expectation. And he related it to, you know, a child that comes out of the womb, comes into the world. Are there expectations that the child needs to do or achieve something to be happy? No, it just naturally is. So being present, being mindful is important. And under the strategic detachment, he says, many children undergo experiences that place enormous obstacles in the way of the development of self-esteem. Everyone knows this. A child may find the world of parents and other adults incomprehensible and threatening. The self is not nurtured, but attacked. The will to be conscious and efficacious is assaulted. After a number of unsuccessful attempts to understand adult policies, statements, and behavior, many children give up and take the blame for their feelings of helplessness. And I tended to do that, unfortunately, tragically, when I was little. They often sense miserably, desperately, and inarticulately that something is terribly wrong with their elders or with themselves or with something. What they often come to feel is, I'll never understand other people. I'll never be able to do what they expect of me. I don't know what's right or wrong, and I'm never going to know. So that is a deep sense of insecurity, you know, and that is no picnic.
Yep.
It's very painful for children, and the way to heal is to live more consciously, right? To grasp these principles of self-esteem and to realize that there was nothing ever really wrong with us, and we are fit for existence and we're worthy of happiness. And incorporating those principles in relation to our own lives on this planet is so vital for our success, you know, our psychological success, financial success, relationship success,
yeah,
societal success, right?
Absolutely. And that was the trouble there was what I was speaking about at the very beginning of the show, the weird alien world, or feeling like I was weird and alien in the world, not having the vocabulary to express that stuff. So also, you know, being surrounded by people who really didn't understand it and just kind of left with this question of what's wrong with me, so common. And you mentioned your experience too. You said you internalized your shortcomings, or...
I went introverted, you know. I didn't think I could make sense of things, other people. Like, this really resonates with me. You know, I will never understand other people. I'll never be able to do what they expect of me. I don't know what's right or wrong, and I'm never going to know. Mm-hmm. Now, I think I had a sense that something was definitely awry. Like, I didn't understand it. And it really took an exploration of philosophy later in life, in college, actually, after college, reading Atlas Shrugged, to gain a real understanding of what's going on in the culture, the nature of self-sacrifice, the nature of, you know, sacrificing others to self, all these systems of domination and punishment.
Yeah.
You know, praise and rewards on the flip side. You know, all this, the power over strategies were immense. And I guess for people that are really sensitive emotionally, the tendency can be just to give up and withdraw.
Absolutely.
But like he says here, the heroic child who continues to struggle to make sense out of the world and the people in it, however, is developing a powerful source of strength, no matter what the anguish or bewilderment experienced along the way. Caught in a particularly cruel, frustrating, and irrational environment, he or she will doubtless feel alienated from many of the people in the immediately surrounding world, and legitimately so. But the child will not feel alienated from reality, will not feel, at the deepest level, incompetent to live, or at least he or she has a decent chance to avoid that fate. To persevere with the will to understand in the face of obstacles is the heroism of consciousness. And I did have a sense of that. I thought that nature, you know, the natural world, animals, you know, this was a place I could connect with, you know, and feel secure about. And ultimately, reality is our closest friend and safeguard, because it is how we experience the world. We are interfacing through our process of reason and our perceptions to, you know, sort out fact from fiction, to sort out the mistakes from the helpful decisions and choices and actions that we can take.
Mm-hmm.
So the more aligned with reality we are and become, the more healthy we become, right? We're facing facts, we're facing truths, and we're not in an antagonistic relationship with reality or ourselves, because there's an inner reality too that needs to be acknowledged. And I frankly had a hard time understanding how people could get through their days without acknowledging some of the emotional turmoil that they were experiencing. Sometimes it seemed like they weren't experiencing it, but we know from experience that people are experiencing a whole bunch of different emotions that they oftentimes may not be acknowledging in public.
Right.
You know, a person can be saying, "Hi, how you doing today?" or "How you been this week?" Well, deeply inside, they're feeling majorly depressed.
Yeah.
And we might not know that. You know, I just learned the other day that our neighbor here is terribly depressed. And it's not on the surface so visible, but I guess it's because depression is kind of normalized in our society, you know?
Right.
And it's hard to tell the majorly depressed from the just chronically low-level depressed.
Yeah.
So that this is the result of a culture that is, you know, Ayn Rand called it philosophically bankrupt, but also psychologically impoverished, psychologically unaware. So the more we adopt these principles and understanding of self-esteem, the better able we are to flourish, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so finally, you know, parenting as a vehicle of personal evolution, he has in this chapter, and embedding them in family life. So to see this as a path for personal growth and development, I think is an important thing. We can choose to make any of them a spiritual discipline in the service of our own evolution. We can take the principles that build self-esteem and use our work as an arena in which to apply them, with the result that both performance and self-esteem will rise. We can take the same principles and apply them in our marriage, with the result that the relationship will flourish, other things being equal, and self-esteem will rise. We can take the principles that raise self-esteem in ourselves and apply them to our interactions with our children. We need not pretend to our children that we are, quote, perfect.
Indeed.
That is so important. We can acknowledge our struggles and admit our mistakes. The likelihood is that the self-esteem of everyone in the family will benefit and will earn immense respect from our children and immense love from them as well by admitting that we are not perfect by any stretch, right?
Right.
If we choose to bring 5% higher level consciousness to dealing with our children, to what we say and how we respond, what might we do differently? If we choose to bring a higher level of self-acceptance to our life, what might we convey to our children about self-acceptance? If we choose to bring a higher level of self-responsibility to our parenting, rather than always blaming our mate or our children, what example might we set? If we are more self-assertive, more authentic, what might our children learn from being about being genuine? If we operate at a higher level of purposefulness, what might our children learn about goal achievement and the active orientation toward life? If we bring a higher level of integrity to the task of parenting, in what ways might our children benefit? If we do all of this, in what ways might we benefit? The answer to this last is simple. In supporting and nurturing the self-esteem of our children, we support and nurture our own.
Yeah.
And I think that is very well put, because we have a child self. It's in us. You know, those experiences that we had when we were children mm-hmm. still live on within us. So in a sense, there is that child within that can cause trouble, cause upset.
Always, yeah.
Bring about a need for attending to and nurturing, you know? And so as we learn these ways of nurturing the child self-esteem, we can nurture our own inner child so that we are not always in a upsetting relationship with this person.
Right.
Not, you know, this person inside.
Don't reject it. Don't disown it. Have empathy for him or her, we should say.
Yeah. Lots and lots of empathy. And I remember Brandon has a exercise for people to imagine that they're walking down a road and they see a child underneath a tree next to a stream. And as you approach, you realize that it's you when you were little.
Yeah. You know?
And so as you walk up to this person, your former self, what do you say? What do you do? You know, how do you relate to this person who's under this tree next to a stream, pondering the nature of things?
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. I've got Kitty Pryde and Nightcrawler too. Waiting there for me, yes I do. I do. I've got posters on the wall. I've got Ace Frehley, I've got Peter Criss, waiting there for me, yes I do, I do. In the garage, I feel safe, no one cares about my ways. In the garage where I belong, no one hears me. Words, and I love everyone.